sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The remarkable NFP payrolls number, ECB gives, takes, and maybe gives back something. The machines that are making just absolute craziness and mayhem on Wall Street. We're going to talk about commodities and our special guest, Scott Patterson of the Wall Street Journal, a staff reporter who has a book out called Dark Pools. It's a great time to talk about this and lots more on episode number 274 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome aboard to August. Here we are in the depths of the summer, getting hot down here in South Florida, but not as hot in the things that are going on around the Midwest with the drought. We're going to talk about that in just a moment because we have some things and some ideas I have on some stocks that may be actually in play right now. But we do have a great guest on as well. I want to talk about, boy, there's so much to talk about right now because we're at this incredible inflection point with not only the markets, but what we're seeing is this kind of spread, this change of character where initially we saw in the beginning of this year a decent amount of economic numbers that were looking a little bit better. Payrolls were okay. We saw earnings do really well, revenues do really well, and then enter into, as usual, the summer, the doldrums of the summer, where we see a lot of things change and get a little bit worse. And it's a bit of a pattern. It's a bit of a cycle that we do see. But what's more interesting is that the earnings number that we have coming in from many stocks that have already positioned themselves and provided the actual numbers for the latest quarter have come in above analyst expectations. We've talked about that. But also, I think more importantly, they have come in kind of flat when it comes to revenues when you're looking on a year-over-year basis. And the best way to look at a stock and their earnings is not from last quarter to this quarter. That's important. But look at it in the same period so you can adjust it for seasonality when you look at it 1 year back, same quarter 1 year back, and look at the progression of earnings or EPS and revenue. Now, we saw some things happen like we talked about with Amazon, how Amazon put in a just absolutely horrid number where they were guiding down. Same thing with Apple. And initially they were down and they came right back up. Investors right now are of the opinion that whether it's due to stimulus or whether it's due to some other means over the course of the next 6 or 12 months, maybe some some kind of a solution to the European situation. Well, things are going to get a lot better and then that's going to allow for companies to do, you know, even better. Well, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that it's been a real hit or miss. The larger caps have done better. The small caps have really gotten just hit. Look what happened recently to, you know, companies that missed in the small cap universe versus what happened in the companies that missed in the large cap universe. Some of that has to do with the amount of balance sheet benefit, the assets they have on board right now. You know, we're looking at Apple at $117 billion of cash on their balance sheet. They started buying a couple of companies, small little deals. And we're seeing that everybody believes that the Amazon, the report that they really put a lot back into the restructuring or the expansion, I guess, would be the best way to describe it, of additional distribution points and having a lot more of a internal build. Well, that was really good for the company. But at the same time, again, you're seeing this kind of real bifurcation of the small caps and large caps, again, just in general, that was quite interesting. The other thing that we're seeing in the markets, if you haven't noticed, is a real wonky pattern where you have 2 or 3 days down, maybe 1%, 0.5%, and then all of a sudden, one day, boom, it's all over, like nothing ever happened. Kind of this amazing, as they call it, stick save, or maybe something else that's going on that maybe all of a sudden one bright spot just causes markets to get crazy. That happened on Friday. We saw markets starting to dip down again and get to points where, on a market basis, they were really looking kind of concerning. We saw the ISM services number come in better on Friday, but yet the ISM manufacturing number, the regular manufacturing number, came in the contraction zone again. Manufacturing has definitely been slowing. Inventories have been building. And we see number after number, probably about, I would say, just off the cuff here, about 75% or more of the economic numbers have been disappointing. And when it comes to looking at the actual numbers from earnings, I got to tell you, they're okay. Yeah, some companies have done really well, but they're, you know, been questionable. You know, but then again, some of that you have to look more at what's happening with the stock rather than the actual news, because a couple things may be happening. The first thing may be that the headline numbers and the actual numbers may not take in consideration all the different elements, maybe some write-downs, possibly some special items. And you want to look at a number that's clean. Amazon is probably one of the companies that I always look at that has probably one of the least clean numbers, because you got to look beneath the surface all the time and really figure out what they're trying to say. We saw that Green Mountain Coffee Roasters came out last week, and they actually halted the stock when the earnings came out. The earnings were abysmal, just absolutely horrible. Outlook was even worse. Meanwhile, the stock opens up down 7, 10, 12, 14%, and then wham, the next day, it's up 25%. I think it's even actually up about almost 30% the next day. It took some back the following day on Friday. But when you look at the action right now, just realize that you have to let things settle in. And that really is the point, what happened last week when it came to the Knight Capital debacle. Now, if you've been following the news, what happened was Knight Capital, who's a market maker, they had a rogue algorithm, a technical glitch, that cost them $450 million so far. It cost them a lot more from the lack of flow that they got, because a lot of companies weren't doing business with them over the next several days. Now, here's what happened, essentially. They flicked a switch on a new algorithm that would go out and buy and sell stocks according to order flow that they had. And maybe that was going to do something like, okay, over a week, I want you to accumulate a 500,000 share position in this company and maybe sell this one down over next month or so, whatever it may be. Well, what happened was that the thing went kind of bonkers, and it blew out all the trades just as they turned the algorithm on. 9:30 in the morning, all of a sudden you saw stocks dropping and rising, and things were up 10, 20, 30%. Some stocks were down 10%. And in the end, they actually went back and they busted many of the trades on five or six different stocks. But at the same time, they had to make good on many of the bad trades and ticks that went off that weren't supposed to. Now, maybe we can actually glean some information off of this and figure out which stocks moved dramatically and figure out if they moved up. Well, there was a buy program in on that, and that means, you know, that some institutional investors are actually out there looking at these to buy. And those that dropped down, maybe there was the investors that were putting in big programs to sell. So I want you to think about that and look if there's anything that kind of plays out. You can take a look at what happened in the morning, the first thing on Wednesday morning of last week, and see what stocks were kind of high. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put that down right now, and I'm going to see if we can do a list of the stocks that were most affected. There was about 140 stocks, and I'll get that list and figure out, maybe we'll post something on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on if there's anything to be looking at. Who knows? There's maybe a little edge in that. Now, we'll talk with Scott Patterson from the Wall Street Journal about this, because I have a lot of questions on really what the effect of many of these dark pools and these algorithms have and where they're going. And I think it's going to be very interesting, because he's been following this. Now, Knight Capital lost about 80% of their value, and then on Friday, they were up about, I don't know, 50%, I think it was, because there were some of the players that would have come in and help recapitalize and offset their losses. Now, one of the things that you have to remember here is that they are responsible for busting those trades, and they're internally taking the hit on that. About 2 years' worth of their overall income is what they're going to have to pay. So when you look at this situation, it's a much bigger concern in that, you know, how much of an influence do these algorithms really have, and how much are they really moving markets, and what is the potential? I am certain there's going to be some kind of congressional hearing which will make all sorts of fun commentary, news, and all sorts of great theater. But we'll kind of take a look at that in the future. But right now, I want you to just consider what's gone on. It was kind of, I guess, like a mini, a very small flash crash, which brings back some of the negative atmosphere of what happened a couple of years ago, but at least the vulnerability of markets right now because of the thin trading volume. As a matter of fact, Friday, that update that we saw that was responsible, that was said to be responsible because of the reason was the NFP payrolls were 160,000, only 100,000 were expected. The 8.3% print on unemployment was a little bit higher by 0.1%. The funniest thing was that the White House came out and said, no, no, the employment rate is really 8.254. Like, that's a big deal. So we should have rounded it down, not up. But what I mean, 8.2, 8.3, big deal. But they had to make a big stink about there was an extra decimal in there or two that was going to be, you know, a big issue. Now, remember something, that the labor unemployment rate, labor participation rate dropped again. And you would have expected to see a better unemployment rate, maybe down to 8.1 or 8, but that didn't happen. So you have to consider that when you're looking at that unemployment rate, that things aren't as rosy. We saw some areas like the ADP that does, in fact, confirm out the numbers that we saw. But again, there was a lot of seasonality going on with the auto industries over the last couple months and all. And I think that this might be a slight aberration, although maybe not that much. I would bet the revisions will come down a little bit and some, you know, birth-death model slash seasonality will come in because the household survey actually showed a significant loss of jobs. So that differential is going to come into question. But nonetheless, between the fact that Mario Draghi is coming up with all sorts of commentary that maybe he can or cannot do about bond buying, et cetera, is something to really consider. We're going to talk about that. And when it comes to the blatherings and the jawboning that goes on in Europe right now, I've kind of lost a lot of respect for many of these central bankers because the movement that they have created in these markets right now is quite extraordinary. And the reason for that seems to be that they're just out there doing their best, obviously, as their job description does say that they should do, is they're supposed to be cheerleaders for the economy and making sure that things don't fail and providing some outlook. But what's happened is they've gone above and beyond that. What's happened is they are being, well, let's just say untruthful. They are creating an environment that has such swings in it due to the currency moves. Look what happened with the euro. It's up 1.75% on Friday, which obviously was a big issue why the dollar was down. Oil was up, I think, 5% on Friday. And at the same time, markets really responded very well. Spain was up about 6%. Italy was up about 6%. Germany was up about 3% on Friday. And all this is after a big down day the day before, because when Draghi came out and spoke, he did not mention anything about bond buying. He did not mention anything about any kind of intervention. And he didn't reduce rates on Thursday. Wednesday, the Fed came out and basically said they're going to keep their long-term interest rates as they are and keeping it low. And I got to tell you something. I read an interesting story in a brief done by Bloomberg recently, and I agree with it very much. And we've talked about this before. That I think the worst thing the Fed can do is to continually state that the interest rates will be long for an extended period of time and target a time like 2014. And the reason for that is it doesn't get anybody off their duff to do anything. Figure, well, I don't need to buy a house right now because mortgage rates are low. They're going to stay low for a while. I don't need to do anything. The only thing it does is scare people into believing that they need to move their assets into higher yielding assets because their CDs are not yielding anything. Their bonds are, you know, if they buy new bonds, they're very low. So where are they going? They're going to dividend paying, preferred, etc. And that's creating a false sense of reality, because what happens is that, you know, at the same time, if you notice, the bonds are being bid up. So we have 10 years somewhere at an all-time low in terms of yield and price, of course, high. The 30-year is at a close to a record low at the same time in terms of yield. And overall, the problem is that it's not getting the business cycle. It's not creating an environment that is anything that is quote-unquote normal. you know, what is normal? Well, you look at the last 50 or 60 years of economic cycles, and you can see some abnormalities in this. But, you know, right now what they're doing is they're creating such an environment that is so distorted by low interest rates and jawboning that no wonder the markets are nutso. No wonder why you have a couple days down and a big drop during the middle of the day if they say this or that. The problem still is that there is this expectation that Germany is going to go along with the bond buying. But you know what? They can't. Because if you look at the Bundesbank, they've been saying they're not going to do it. Now, if they go along and do it all of a sudden, I think the whole curtain will be raised on the absolute lack of integrity that they have. Now, meanwhile, we talked about these machines. We talked about the amazing NFP numbers. We talked about the ECB and what they're doing. Okay, that's all embedded in the market. One of the things that's going on also that I think deserves some time to discuss, besides the fact that we have low volume and not a lot of participation, is the incredible rise of some commodities. In particular, let's take a look at corn. Let's take a look at wheat. Let's take a look at beans. Oil is going back up into the 90s again. And what does that mean? Well, we know we've talked about this at length, that many of the restaurants and providers of poultry or meats are really having a hard time. You know, they're either going to have to eat their profits, so to speak, or they're going to have to raise prices. We saw Chipotle come out with an earnings number with an outlook that was pretty horrible, although we think it's basing around this price right now. We actually own a piece of that. At the same time, you look at companies like a Buffalo Wild Wings, which we are short and which we continue to be so. We hit the short very nicely, both on trigger points and on our portfolios at TDI, Managed Growth Strategy, and for about an 18% gain. And then took our foot off it, covered it, and it went up about 5, 6, 7%, and we're back short to it again. There's nothing getting better in this area per se. The problem right now is that these companies that deal in this are still not getting a lot of price push by the providers. You know, you look at companies like SAFM, Sanderson Farms, Pilgrim's Pride, PPG, Tyson, TSON. These companies have really been suffering. If you look at any of these charts, it is a horrifying view. It looks like a ski slope straight down, and which is pretty much inverted to the price of corn. Corn increasing again to add close to a record on Friday. Now, corn's used for a lot of things. One of the things it's used for is ethanol, which we may see some kind of law or at least some kind of reprieve if they decide to kind of slow that down a little bit, the requirements that they have at the government level. But more importantly, it would seem that at this point that these companies are going to have to do something about raising their prices. Either that or they're going to have to do some very significant hedging. The question is, do they do the hedging now when prices are so high? That would seem a little bit illogical. At the same time, you want to look at these companies because, you know, these are good companies. Are they going to go out of business? I don't think so. Do they have problems because of the natural environment, Mother Nature? Yeah, sure. The you know, somewhere about maybe 60% of the crops have been absolutely destroyed. And the question is going to be, where is the next crop going to come from, or what alternatives can they use for feed? So we looked at this and we said, you know what? Tyson Foods is coming out, I believe, next week with earnings. Pilgrim's Pride, a bit after that. Sanderson is coming out in about, I think, 2 weeks or so. And we looked at these as, you know what? These are one of those stocks, situations that now is, wow, everybody hates it. Nobody wants to be in it. There's a decent short interest on these. You know, from a contrarian value play, these are looking pretty snappy. As a matter of fact, if you look at them, the move down has come on very light overall volume through this last swing. And that's interesting because when you see that, any move up, oftentimes it's going to create a massive short squeeze. So what we're doing is we're looking at a position potential if we see a little bit of a rebound here in all three, but in particular, Sanderson Farms we like, and we've had them in investments, I mean, years ago. they were an interesting place to be. But you know what? If we see corn prices start to come down a little bit, you know, a way to think about something. You know, what happened with natural gas? Well, natural gas pricing was low. There wasn't a lot of use, and coal was being used. All of a sudden, natural gas prices come down so much that all of a sudden there's a realization that, hey, this may be a great alternative to coal. Well, they start coming down more. They start coming down more. It got to a point that became irresistible. Natural gas was punching in at $2 per whatever the unit is of natural gas. Then we saw $2, and it was hanging around there for a while. And then the realization came. Coal was starting to come down because all of a sudden they were shutting down the coal plants. They were shutting down the energy that was created, the facilities that were creating energy through coal and switching over to natural gas. And many of the new things that were being built, whether it was energy facilities or manufacturing facilities, were in the area of natural gas use. So now what we're seeing is kind of the opposite if you think about it, right? Natural gas was all of a sudden being used and it was picking up. The opportunity was great. And now you saw the price move from about $2 to $3 in the last several months, 50% gain. Well, all of a sudden when you see an aberration like we're seeing, well, all of a sudden you have to wonder if they're going to lay off using corn and look for alternatives. And if that's the case, corn prices come down. You know, how high can they go? You know, after a while, it doesn't make any sense anymore to use that as a feed product and look for alternatives, either outside of the normal channels where they buy it, or again, alternatives. What are the alternatives? Well, that's a good question. But now these farmers who are, you know, in the poultry business, again, have two different possible choices. Well, maybe three. Third one, which is go out of business, is probably not realistic. There's another one which may be merge or be bought. Interesting. Then you have the opportunity for them to raise prices. Now, again, any of these are, besides going out of business, are good alternatives. Maybe they could become really good targets for people to pick them up. Companies may be looking for spreading out. Maybe they're in the food business already, like a Smithfield in the pork business. Maybe they want to get into the chicken business, and it's a great time because these other companies are suffering. Or at the same time, the companies say, you know what, we're going to do two things. We're going to finance some more debt. We're going to do some share buybacks, spook out the shorts. And at the same time, what we're going to do is we're going to raise our prices slowly. And then what happens is when they start raising their prices, that maybe they're going to bring it up a point. There'll be less chicken bought. And at the same time, that means less feed needed. And the cycle then moves to corn prices coming down over time. We also have the next year's harvest potentially out there. And at the same time, you also have government coming in to bail out some of these guys. So when you look at all of this and you look at what's going on, it would seem to me that there is a great opportunity in one, two, or three of these names right now. And at the same time, we see the opposite being true for certain places that rely on a lot of poultry. For example, I'll go back to Buffalo Wild Wings. They talked about the fact that chicken prices have increased about 80% over the last however long. Well, already we're seeing chicken prices go up. Well, wait a minute. If chicken prices are going up, analysts have been dropping their estimates dramatically on these companies. Wait, maybe they're already starting to increase their costs, their prices. If they're increasing their prices, maybe earnings aren't going to be as bad as expected. So I want you to take a very good look at these companies, look at them fundamentally, look at them technically. You'll see that SAFM, Sanderson Farms, is basing out and has an opportunity. Look at that giant gap. Look at the very quick zone that has showed up. And this is something that we're looking at very closely as a really interesting play because, you know, you can get into this on a long position, whether it's through an option or directly through the stock ownership. And then at the same time, you know, if things don't play out, okay, so you move on, you take a little bit of loss. But the upside opportunity over time looks really interesting right now. I got a couple of things that I want to talk to you about, a couple of names, but let's get to our guest. I really want to get him in there. Before we do that, let's talk about GoToMeeting. Great, great service. GoToMeeting. It is one of my favorite things where we share various PowerPoint presentations. We do one-on-ones. We do group meetings. And GoToMeeting is one of those really great performing sort of like cloud service because it's all on the web. You don't have to really download anything per se. There's a little plugin that comes along automatically. when you log in, whether it's on Firefox or Internet Explorer or Safari, it works on every platform. And GoToMeeting, what's nice about it, especially with their HD high-def faces, is a way that you can not only share your information, but you can actually go out and you can share your emotions at the same time. You could talk to people and talk to them face-to-face while having one of the best virtual meetings that you can ever have. What I want you to do is simply go over so you can get your 30-day free GoToMeeting and go to GoToMeeting.com. The little box there, you know, says where do you hear about us or, you know, what do you want to do? Click it, try it free, and make sure to use the promo code podcast. So go over to GoToMeeting.com, click the try it free button, and then use the promo code podcast, and then have yourself a great virtual meeting. Check it out with friends. Share a few things, share some charts. Maybe pull up these charts we're talking about right now with them and see what they think. GoToMeeting.com. All right, now, you know, I thought it would be really great. There was an introduction made by a listener to someone. His name is Scott Patterson. He's a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he is the author of a fascinating book called Dark Pools. And there's a little bit of a longer name. But one of the things that is really great, the timing couldn't have been better, Scott, for talking about some of the things that are going on right now.
Yeah, you know, the hits just keep coming this year. We had the BATS IPO just crash. Facebook and NASDAQ was a flub, the IPO of Facebook. And now Knight Capital, which just basically shot itself in the head with a rogue algorithm, which on page 10 of my book, I cite a researcher who predicted that this year a firm would lose $1 billion on an algorithm that went into an infinite loop, which apparently this thing kind of did that. And if you count the amount of market cap and the $440 million loss at night, it's around $1 billion, if not more.
Now, one of the things that happened here is there's conflicting stories out, and I don't know if you can help us with this, but basically Knight Capital, who's a market maker, they open up the morning and their algorithm, their machines, started spitting out trades, both buys and sells. It almost looked like it was supposed to be trades that were going to be pushed in the market throughout the day utilizing whatever specific calculation and algorithm they had, but it kind of just kept on pushing them in, and stocks went haywire. Mm-hmm. And there's some discussion that this was a new program that was initiated. Was it something that they've already used, or is it something that was brand new?
Right. Well, that's the chatter. I don't think we have nailed it down at the Journal yet exactly what this thing was, but it looks like it was a new trading system designed for a retail trading operation that was being set up at the New York Stock Exchange. You know, the chatter is that they were kind of rushing it, and they hadn't really properly tested it. And, you know, Wednesday was the first day of this retail trading program at the New York Stock Exchange, and they, you know, hit the button at 9:30 a.m. On Wednesday, and it just went crazy. And people are saying it was something that was supposed to trade for days, if not weeks, and it executed all the trades in about, you know, 30 or 45 minutes.
And now here's the problem. The problem is that we have a company that had, I think, this loss of about $440 million was their total take of revenue over the last couple of years. And now the question is, what's going to happen to this company? And the stock is down 75, 80% in the last number of days. I'm sure a lot of people want to play this for a trade, you know, going into what may be a rescue by a company like Citadel or somebody else. But I'm reading a lot that companies are, you know, from Ameritrade to there's probably five or six Fidelity. They're not doing any trades with Knight. So not only did they lose on the fact that they had to make up these bad trades, but now they've kind of lost flow.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of think of it like what happened to Bear Stearns when there was a lot of rumors about Bear going down. It's sort of like a run on the bank, because this is where they get their money from, the flow of their clients, you know, and it's not TD Ameritrade, it's Fidelity and Vanguard and, you know, giant mutual fund companies that send their retail orders tonight. They're not routing them tonight now. So Knight's going to need to get, a white knight to come in and rescue them,
right?
Potentially, or a huge capital infusion so that their clients aren't afraid that something dramatic is going to go down and their orders are going to get stuck there and they're going to lose money.
I mean, I would think that the first thing that you mentioned about possibly a white knight coming in is a much better situation than possibly just a capital infusion, because with the capital infusion, you know, there's still unknown what the ramifications are going to be. And, you know, we see that there have been, you know, people that come in that way. I mean, it would be better to fold in what they have and then try to rebuild to get back to where they were with somebody taking them over. Wouldn't that make more sense?
I think that's probably the most likely outcome here. You know, I mean, when you look at the stock, it's down so much that I think a lot of firms out there are kind of licking their chops and saying, like, you know, Knight's got a good system. They've got a lot of good people. I mean, you know, this is one of the biggest volume traders in the world that, you know, we're talking about. And, you know, number one, number two at times on New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. So, you know, it's a powerful company. I think a lot of people haven't really heard of it, but any retail trader out there, most likely they've been putting their orders through Knight. They just didn't know it. They thought they were trading on, you know, E-Trade.
Yeah.
So they also have a very profitable high-frequency trading system, proprietary trading system at Knight. It's, you know, pretty secretive, but, you know, so there's some good assets there, and you would think that, you know, there's firms looking at them and, you know, thinking they'd be a good partner.
So let's talk a little bit about the bigger picture, because this is obviously something that you have been warning about. But you have high-frequency trading. We have algorithms possibly gone wild. We have machine-based trading instead of, you know, turning. As a matter of fact, most people don't know this, but I think that the New York Stock Exchange auction system, traditional auction system where you see kind of, or the pits, for example, in Chicago, are the last, they're a dinosaur. I mean, you go around the world, no one else is anything but electronic trading.
Right, yeah, it's totally taken over. I think that the, you know, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange now is sort of like a studio for CNBC. I went on CNBC several weeks ago and said that when I was, you know, on, and I'm not sure they appreciated that.
No, you can't. Don't say anything bad about the economy or
about
CNBC.
It's true. You know, I mean, you know, I was surprised. So when I was there that morning, you know, I was there for the open, which I used to cover the exchanges for the Wall Street Journal, and I've been there at the open and the close and seen it. It's, you know, it used to be crazy. Things had settled down after a half hour or so, but, you know, when I was there, it opened, and I was watching these guys, these, you know, market makers, and they were just talking. The bell rang, and they just kept talking.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything to do.
Right, no, obviously.
You know? So
unionized,
the computers are running everything.
Yeah. You know? So what does that mean? What does that mean, though?
I don't think people realize that how fast this has happened. This revolution in trading has happened. I mean, it started decades ago, and I trace the whole history of it in my book, specifically focusing on the stock market. But the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, it has just completely accelerated into a new world, and the regulators have no idea about, you know, how to keep this thing under control.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the concept of, we've in the past on the show talked about high frequency trading, and, you know, there's a debate out there whether or not there would be a lack of liquidity in the event that they would be pulled. I'll tell you something, there's a lack of liquidity with them there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, so I don't know what, you know, that can't help them being pulled, although I don't like the whole nature of it. Decimalization has been said to be a problem and a reason for the growth of this, because it's much harder to do market making with a penny spread versus a quarter. And like the old days, you know, people don't move as fast and you can't get that penny spread. But let's talk about dark pools. That's something we've really never talked about. Kind of explain to us and walk us through what that's all about.
Right. Well, you know, dark pools were designed to allow firms the opportunity to escape the high-frequency traders, actually. And early 2000s, as more and more computers started coming online, these big institutional firms started worrying that their orders were getting picked off, because the high-frequency computers can detect the patterns when they're trading and front-run them, essentially. So, you know, some dark pools opened up. These are off-exchange private venues, very secretive, where firms put in orders, and the bids and offers aren't reported to the rest of the market, to the consolidated tape. So you can put in orders, they're hidden, and you're not alerting the high frequency systems to their presence. That's changed now. If you look at dark pools now, they're totally infested with high-frequency traders. The average trade size of a dark pool is something like, 200 shares per order. So that's exactly what is happening on the exchange now. It's not any different. It originally was big blocks of thousands of shares at a time. So, it's basically what I'm saying in the book is there's no place to hide. And I'm also saying that the stock exchanges themselves are dark. They're not, these are called the lit markets because the bids and offers are posted. But I challenge anybody to look at that, deep into what's going on in the market and say, explain to me what exactly is going on, because they don't know. And in fact, there are lots of hidden orders put up in stock markets now. And that's one of the problems that I really try to get at is what's going on with these hidden orders that are designed to get around regulations. And they're, from talking to the traders and, some people specifically that I write about, they think that these things can front run regular investors. So, and the exchanges have provided these orders too, so they're in on it.
Well, of course, because they make money from the whole trade flow.
Yeah, that's the game now. The high frequency guys are running the show. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The exchanges have to cater to them. That's how they get the liquidity. They need the liquidity, so they go to them. I talked to guys who work at exchanges, and they told me, I do nothing all day but work with high frequency guys, asking them, what can I do to make life better for you?
Right.
And that basically means, what can I do to help you make money?
Right. The way I see high frequency trading is that it is simply scraping a little bit of profit off the top of trades, and that is right against the, who loses on that? Well, it's the investor. Now, it may not be a lot, it may be a very small amount, but when you look at the high frequency nature of it, the amount of trades that we're dealing with and the amount of movement, I will tell you, when I trade stocks, we can actually hide our trades. We can go in and put in small orders and try to, that's the standard thing that you've done for years. We're not the same thing that you've talked about here. We don't want to put in a trade of buying 10,000 shares at a clip and tip off anybody and move the market on it, right? So,
right.
But the problem is that even buying 100 shares, 200 shares, moves the bidder ask. It's kind of spooky.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that you have to be very careful in how you tiptoe into positions, and the amount of short squeezes and reversals in the market. It seems to me that many of these algorithms are set up to kind of take things down the limit, spook out investors, and then buy it back and drag them back in.
Yeah, no question. There are so many games being played. I've talked to high frequency guys. They've told me some of the tricks that, their ability to monitor what's going on across the market in, 30, 40 different venues. They know what's going on in all those venues, or their computers do. They're able to process it in microseconds and react. So, a typical trader might be looking at what's going on in, five or six different places if they're really good and vigilant. But they're not looking at 40, and they're not programmed to game the system in ways that the regulators look at things and they see weird patterns. But often there's not enough evidence for them to accuse firms of rigging the market or manipulating shares. I mean, I just wrote a page one story for the journal about this global day trading firm, formerly known as SwiftTrade. That has day traders. They're trading electronically from places like China. They look at the patterns and they can tell that they're manipulating stocks, but they can't prove that there's manipulation. It's very hard to prove it. So that goes back again to the dark nature of the market that I'm talking about, that things have become so complex that these games can go on, and it seems like the regulators can't do anything to stop it.
Maybe this is one of the reasons why people have been pulling money out on a regular basis over the last 24 months from even mutual funds and from the markets and putting them into bonds and things like that. Although mm-hmm. most people don't realize the games that can be played with bonds as well. Now, obviously, they're affected by the Fed.
They just seem more stable. They've got a steady stream of income, but there's games going on everywhere. Currencies, futures, you know, it's totally a casino. I mean,
it is a casino, but you know, one of the things
but is anything going to be done to stop it? I don't know. I mean,
well,
I'm losing my faith in the ability of the regulators or even the do they even really care? Are they complacent? I don't know. I mean, you think that with, you know, something like Knight and Facebook and the flash crash, that they would really be up in arms.
You would think
people know that they're going to do something about it.
I mean, you would think so, but at the same time, they only get upset when things go down. When things go up,
yeah,
and they go out of control on the upside, nobody gets pissed off. You know, it's, oh, okay. It's, you know, it's this whole Machiavellian approach to it where, okay, fine, LIBOR. Let me tell you something. Let me back up. The whole LIBOR scandal, okay? The fact of the matter is that we knew about it here in the United States, not us, but the regulators, let's say. They kind of knew about it in Europe, too. They did nothing about it because it was for the benefit of the banks at the time. And nobody was so concerned about it because, you know what? If they would have busted this thing wide open, the whole worldwide environment and the buying of banks would have been shut down, and it would have been even worse for everybody. So they figure, you know what? Let it go by a little bit. And, you know, if nothing else happens bad, okay, that's great. Look at what happened with this week. And, you know, we have last week, this big move on the markets, 2.5% or so on last two Fridays ago, when Mario Monti and the gang over there are all about, hey, you know what? We're going to buy bonds. And we're all scratching our heads saying, wait a minute, Germany's totally opposed to this. How are you going to do that?
Yeah.
And then the week goes on. He doesn't do anything during his Thursday. Markets kind of fall off. Amazingly, there's a little article from one of the folks at your place that has constantly been very timely. Now what is his name? He's the
John Hilsenrath.
Yeah, thank
he's
you.
Our Fed reporter.
Yeah, he's your Fed. We'll leave it at that. We'll be kind. He seems to have some very timely information.
People got to cut him a break. He's just doing his job.
I understand that.
Well, I understand that there's, you know, a lot of chatter out there, but what is he supposed to do? If he gets information, is he supposed to just not report it?
No, I have no problem.
I don't understand
with that.
What people think he's.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't think they're really directing it at him so much rather than the whole process. Maybe they're directing it at him. I don't know. Let me tell you, I'm directing at the process, that there's this magic stick shaves just when markets are falling off and they fundamentally don't look good and economics aren't good, and you get a 3 o'clock story. You know, better than that is the 3 o'clock stories that we get out of Europe, which means it's like 9 o'clock over there. What are they doing up? Mm-hmm. What are they doing talking at 9 o'clock at night constantly? You know, it's an amazing thing, and what I find most remarkable about this is the amount of chatter. I don't know how long you've been doing this, but I've been doing this a while. I do not recall so much chatter on things that are trying to boost markets by central banks on a continual basis than I've seen recently. And it almost looks like, and I don't mean any disrespect by this, but the press, we'll take your paper out of this so I won't talk about you. The press is being played a little bit, you know, by just vacant information that doesn't have any actual staying power. And then we saw again this week that the same discussion about bond buying, and then the Spanish markets are up like 6%. You know, I mean, this is a kind of a crazy environment that's going on both sides. But, you know, on one hand...
Well, you know, this has been going on for, you know, I mean, since 2007. This isn't really new. I mean, I think that the European situation is sort of new, but I mean it's sort of like a recurring nightmare. It's like every week is, you know, the market is either up on, you know, some new European plan, and then it's down because they realize it's not going to work, and it just goes back and forth. And you know, I mean they're totally in a box over there. And in the U.S., I mean August 2007, the Fed started moving and, you know, making signs they're going to move, and this has been nonstop ever since. You know, now that we've been for years at a point where they can't even touch the Fed funds rate, you know, I don't know the last time I heard anybody even talk about the Fed funds rate. So they're doing all these other, you know, fancy programs like Operation Twist to keep things going. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of it is jawboning and just hoping things are just to push it along. You know, are they pushing on a string? Is the economy going to gain traction? I think it's a lot of it is just like, you know, let's wait and see. And hopefully, you know, things are going to calm down and markets will get back up. And, you know, I mean, Alan Greenspan was certainly somebody who was, you know, more than willing to play everything, every card he can, including the press, and to, you know, get the market up, and you know, using that as a way to stimulate the economy. I mean, whether the Fed should be involved in that is another debate. I'm not a Fed expert. I mean, I've written a lot about the economy over the years, but you know, I've turned to high frequency trading as the thing I bang on now.
So let's talk about
that.
Let's talk about
it. It is
that.
What it is. I think at the end of the day, should the Fed be abolished? I mean, that's not a realistic argument.
Right. So let's talk about that. Let's kind of close this up with this. So what's your kind of longer term? So we know about the high frequency trading, the problems of that, the dark pools, of course, the issues with that, trading debacles, algorithms. What is the kind of logical outcome of this, kind of fast forward, I don't know, a year, 2 years, whatever?
Well, you know, I think what Knight shows us, and it's something that I've been concerned about, is that, you know, is this a too big to fail issue? Because, you know, you look at the giant multinational banks like, you know, J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, they have very big high-frequency trading market-making operations inside the banks. People don't really know about that, but they do. What happens if, you know, B of A has an algorithm that goes crazy and isn't just, you know, half a billion? I mean, but not that that wasn't, you know, horrendous, but, you know, you're talking, you know, it could be billions. We don't know. I mean, with these markets, these moves, the, you know, black swan-like moves can go in directions that nobody can predict. And, you know, what if, you know, the Knight algorithm had gone bonkers on a day when the market was really volatile? Because Wednesday, it was pretty steady.
Right.
So there were plenty of people coming in and willing to, you know, buy when that algorithm was selling. But what if, you know, things were chaotic? You could have seen prices just, you know, plunge. I mean, that thing was trading big blue chip companies,
right,
like Ford and Berkshire Hathaway. So it could have been much worse, and it could hit a too big to fail bank. So that's something I think that, you know, the regulators, you know, including the Fed, should be looking at is, you know, do we have a system here where a trading computer program, because somebody, you know, put in the wrong code, creates a situation where you need a bailout of a bank. Hmm. Taxpayers get hit all over again. I mean, we've seen this before.
And that's why they'll continue to do it. Last question about the CTFC. CFTC? I always get those two letters backwards. Anyway.
CFTC?
Yeah, CFTC. What's your take on that whole situation there? Because that's something that's been questioned about the regulation. You got Bart Chilton, who, I don't even know. I mean, I can't make heads or tails of these guys. It seems like they're supposed to, you know, Gary. No, not Gary. What's the head of the guy's name?
Gensler.
Yeah, Gary Gensler. Yeah, I spoke with him a couple of times, and I was shocked about his commentary when I talked with him. He basically said that when I said, "Hey, you know, what's the deal when gold drops, you know, 5%, and then later in the day you find out that there was a tightening of the margins? Who knew about that before? How come that's what's the story on that?" He said, "We don't really get involved in those kind of things, more so about leaks of government economic data and things like that." And I said, "I'm sure I haven't heard this correctly. Fortunately, I taped it, by the way. But it seems to me that there is a very lax policy. They were supposed to come up with some rules that they're about a year, well, maybe now they're 2 years late on a framework for rules and all that to stop speculation and all that. Whatever happened?"
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those rules have been approved. I'm not sure if they've been implemented yet. I don't think they are, but they're supposed to be later this year. They're position limits, and, you know, how many positions a firm that is deemed a speculator can take in a particular commodity or futures contract. So it was very controversial. The, you know, Wall Street hated it,
mm-hmm.
and the CFTC did push it through. So, you know, maybe that could have an impact. It's hard to say. You know, the efficient markets people say, you know, no, you know, let the traders go, you know, because they create an efficient market. You know, I mean, that's sort of an ideological debate. I am just increasingly over the years more prone to, you know, giving the regulators the firepower they need, but, you know, I also am very skeptical about the ability of the regulators to put in the right rules. It seems like, you know, or put them in quick enough. It just seems like they're just really navel-gazing, bureaucrats. The CFTC has been a little different. Gensler has been pretty aggressive. He's done things that a lot of people hate on Wall Street, which, you know, I mean, I sort of see that as a good thing. What you're talking about, weird things going on inside the markets with, you know, margins and there's also a lot of high frequency games going on in futures markets. I think they're really struggling to keep up with stuff like that because they don't have the tools to track it.
Yeah, there's clearly
a pretty small agency too.
Well, and you know, the whole thing, I mean, if you look at a correlation with the dollar / euro, better the euro, and the S&P futures, I mean, it is a ridiculously high correlation. I mean, it almost looks like there's an algorithm or some kind of trading mechanism that is clearly just, as it moves, we move this. If it moves that, it moves that. You know,
I think the euro-dollar, a lot of these trading systems use that as a very powerful signal to buy and sell stocks.
Yeah,
now.
I agree.
And that's why that's another sort of nightmare scenario that I'm concerned about is, you know, what if something happens in Europe, you know, news comes out, Greece says we're going to default, we're pulling out of the euro, boom. You see a massive move in the euro, and there's a lot of computer trading in those currencies, and what if that causes a flash crash like move in the currency market that will immediately spill over into the stock market because of these correlations.
And if you're playing on if you are trading on a daily basis, the truth of the matter is right now, it's if you play with S&P futures, whatever, you're really actually playing currencies. It's kind of what you want to think about.
Yeah.
I'll send you a quick correlation, just a tick chart. It's quite remarkable to look at on number of days. So anyway, Scott Patterson, you got to check out his book. It's a great thing. First of all, his writings in the Wall Street Journal. Give us the full name. I know it's a little bit longer of your book, Dark Pools.
It's Dark Pools, High Speed Traders, AI Bandits, and the Threat to the Global Financial System.
There you go. Lots of good stuff in there and stuff to really think about. I appreciate you coming aboard today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Now, what does the next week or so hold for us? Well, that's an interesting question. Very little on the economic front that is going to be discussed. We have one or two different things happening. Some earnings coming out that we have to be aware of. But again, it's going to be all eyes pointing to Europe. Now, I want to tell you something, that right now we seem to be getting towards the top of the range. Our market trend indicator and our key reversal indicator are getting a little bit hot. Market trend is clearly in an uptrend right now, although it's been a weird way to get there. Very staircasey and odd, to say the least. But what's interesting is that we are hitting a recent high. There's some resistance here at this level, but then you head into the 1400 level plus about 1410 or so. Maybe 1420, I believe, if I can recall the chart on the S&P 500. And that's really kind of interesting because with earnings being questionable, economics being just lukewarm at best, Europe in a recession and possibly a depression, unresolved things happening around the world. China at the same time is slowing down remarkably. And the emerging markets, India and Brazil, really not doing anything great there. You know, really what we're having is a lot of, as I guess Mohammed Arian would say, a sugar high. Now, there's a recent article out by Bill Gross from the same firm over at PIMCO that was talking about how stocks have kind of hit their peak. They've hit their stride. There's not much more left here because they can't sustain these kind of PE multiples and these kind of growth rates in an environment where we have a sub 2% GDP. Now, that was interesting. That's met with a lot of resistance and a lot of question about, you know, why is he talking about this? Is he just talking his book, you know, having the biggest bond fund in the world? And, you know, there is this new normal concept out there, higher unemployment, lack of liquidity and lack of volume on markets, individual retail investors kind of staying out of it. And where do we go from here? You know, service companies are slowing down a little bit. Technology has been really whacked across the head, although there's been some real standouts out there. And where do we go if, at least when you see that the most defensive names such as defensive sectors, I should say, as utilities and healthcare and telecom have been leading the highest dividend paying stocks, are the ones that are really doing well, which is saying that, hey, you know what? There's a real concern about the markets. And at this time, we'd rather be, if we have to be, in the big cap names that are issuing dividends. So, you know, I want you to consider that, but still look at the players that are leading the market that are looking really good. You're going to see a lot of volatility in individual names. Take your stops and make sure that your stops at a level much lower, not like 30%, but much lower than you would usually say that you would put it, because right now the volatility is going to shake you out dramatically. Make sure that you buy your position on either a basing scenario or a trend up through resistance. And of course, you know, you want to short kind of at the top of the range here, because when you get in at the bottom of the range, it's really a questionable time to do so. There has been an amazing array and a differential between, you know, the good and the bad this quarter. And I've talked to a lot of colleagues, and they're having a hard time right now. As a matter of fact, we're seeing some hedge funds actually pull out of the business right now, close up shop, give back a few $1 billion here or there, because they find the macro environment very difficult. And it is. So if you're having the same situation, I want you to know that you're not alone. It's been tough. It's been a tough ride right now. And, you know, with that, what we're going to do is have this week, hopefully, a number of stocks that we're going to really outline. We're going to talk about these 140 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And we're going to do our best to try to figure out what is going on with this market trend. But if we do see this kind of on-off, risk-on, risk-off situation, which is hard to interpret on a, unless you step back and look at it, right now, it's coming into Monday, and I'm getting a couple of risk-off characteristics showing up on my indicators. You know, and what does that mean? Does that mean a all-out fail? No, it doesn't. It means that unless some fresh blatherings come with some backup, you know, we're seeing that there may be a bit of a risk-off scenario that's starting to build here, and it built towards the end of the day on Friday. Right before that, it was kind of risk-on, but we got a signal that's showing that small caps may be underperforming again. And at the same time, you know, you have a situation where you may see a little bit of a take-back. We call it back and fill in the market. So just keep that aware, but don't get totally spooked out. You got to be both sides straddling right now, the long and the short. So, I mean, if you look at what happened with some of the companies last week, there was plenty of short opportunities and plenty of long opportunities. You know, you just have to hit it right. Anyway, listen, if you do want some more information, you got the 14-day free trial of Trigger Point Research. If you haven't done so already, go get it right now. Go to triggerpointresearch.com. Just click on the, it's everywhere to be seen. Check out some of the things that have happened, the recent alerts that we had, and the results. It's on there. And also, make sure to get that 14-day free trial. I think that's an important thing to do. We have some webinars coming up, of course. We have lots to talk about. There's a nice study that came out saying that beautiful people are more successful. We put that up on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, as well as some of our market trend indicators are coming up this week as well. And we'll focus a little bit more on these poultry stocks and some of the possible timing and indications of when it may be ready to take off rather than fly the coop on these. Anyway, we'll see you soon. Thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it. This is Andrew Horowitz. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.